coming up on this episode of Embracing Change with Lakrita Bowman and Jennifer Osborne.
His best for me was never to go to prison. His best for me was never to live the life I had. And yet, he was taking me back to recollect the pearl that I have always been to him, the diamond I have always been. And so he was stringing up a necklace of diamond and pearls.
Thank you for tuning in to the first episode of Embracing Change. My name is Jennifer Osborne, and I will be your host along with Lakrita Bowman as we take this extraordinary journey. In this episode, we'll be discussing her book, Breaking the Cycle of Self-Abuse, where she went from a five-time convict to being the founder of recovery services at City Gospel Mission in Cincinnati, Ohio. She is a speaker, an author, and a teacher, having led hundreds into realizing they can change the course of their life. So, without further ado, here is our conversation. For the folks who don't know you, here's a few things that I want to share so they can kind of get more familiar with you. You're the founding director of Having the Courage to Change, that you founded along with your husband, Charles Bowman. You are the VP of Recovery Services at City Gospel Mission. You're a licensed pastor. You've been the recipient of the Applauds Magazine Image Maker Award for Advocacy. That's awesome. Your story and your mission has been featured on the Cincinnati Inquirer, the Cincinnati Post, and the Cincinnati Herald when they were around. You've been featured on Fox, on WXIX TV 19, as well as A New Day on WCPO Channel 9. And the one that I really think is interesting is the Maury Povich show that you appeared on that. So
that was before Maury Povich became Maury Povich of today.
Yeah. That had to have been
It was 1995. That was would have been about, no, I'm sorry, that would have probably been, yeah, about 1994.
That's
that
awesome.
I premiered on that.
How did you, just interestingly enough,
get there?
Yeah, how did you?
Someone read my book and they were working with me. Her name was Holly, and she had been a guest on his story before. He was having a guest that dealt with some, you know, some sexual abuse, and he wanted Holly to come, and Holly thought it would be a good idea for me to come because I had actually worked through that process or had faced that demon. And she thought, you know, like, I think Lakrita would be a good person to be on the show with me, so I came as our guest.
Awesome. Where was that? Like, what
in
city?
New York.
It was in New York.
Mm-hmm.
That had to have been an interesting experience, just overall, like interacting with the audience and sharing your story on a national platform.
Yeah, I guess it was more about focusing on the young girl that was 15 years old that had dealt with being sexually abused, you know. So
what came as a result of that show? Did you find that you had more people that were interested in your story from places outside of Cincinnati as a result? Or
not really. I just came on back home and put my hand to the plow and keep doing what I was doing.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it was just an isolated situation. It was more about Holly than it was me. And I didn't try to make it about me. And I went as her guest and shared my story as well, in my experience and what I'm doing to get over that, and hopefully to encourage the young lady to do the same. So I don't know what the outcome of what happened with the young lady.
And in August of last year, you actually had a play that was created from your story, and so that allowed for a lot more exposure in the Cincinnati area to your story. And since I worked with you on that, I know that there's been a lot of people come back and just really were blown away over your overall story, because that covered a lot of starting off from when you were in prison and working through the journey of going back and then being able to move forward as you allowed God into that space.
Mm-hmm.
What was the experience overall for you having your story in a different format?
Just saying my story on the outside and not being ashamed, naked and unashamed. Just, you know, primarily just been naked and unashamed. The experience was a full circle experience, and I was not telling the story. I was on the outside looking at the story and watching the journey I had been through. So the experience for me was a phenomenal one, and it was another level of healing.
What did God really kind of speak to you through that whole thing? I know you got a lot of
insights into different things as it was represented.
Mm-hmm. But I think the three things that he spoke to me primarily was with the ribbon, and the ribbon that was illustrated from a little girl to the final finale of the dance, and that, you know, restoring my childhood back. I think that he gave me the revelation of when her garment was in the bed, that my change was always present. It was just about whether or not I was going to go after it. And the mirror, that I am not to reflect who I was or who I am, but to reflect him. And the image looking back should always look more like him than me.
The play, like I said, was based on your book called Breaking the Cycle of Self-Abuse, and it came out in 2005, and then you re-released it in 2019. And I've read the book. It's incredible. I know that what everybody says that reads the book, they're profoundly moved that you went through a journey of experiencing life. Like, it doesn't take for granted the fact that the journey was hard. But what it does say through your book overall is that you do have to be willing to allow God into those really tough spaces,
mm-hmm.
the really hard parts of yourself, and allow him to work and move and heal. In the first chapter of your book, in your intro, you talk about the journey, and that's where even the play started. So share with me about where you were in prison for the fifth time. How did you hear this voice that was calling to you that kind of set you on this journey?
Well, I was sleeping, so primarily I thought I was dreaming. And the voice sounded like me, but it was saying things to me that I would never say to myself. When the voice came, it kind of starred me up. I thought, again, I was dreaming. So I woke up, I looked around my room. I had four other roommates. I thought maybe somebody was whispering around my bed, playing a game.
Mm-hmm.
But all my roommates, so, you know, they were asleep. So I went back to sleep, or tried to, and it said it again. And I was like, okay. In the end, I'm going to be honest, I thought I was hearing voices. So it kind of took me back to the Longview moment. And so I was like, you know, I'm hearing voices. Like, something is speaking to me and saying things to me, and even giving me some sense of feeling to make me feel inadequate or not really totally in control.
Mm-hmm.
And so in that moment, I just really tried to ignore it. And I guess I must have drifted back to sleep the next morning, you know, as the morning rised, and I got up and did the same thing I always do, put on my prison uniform and went out into the yard and we had this walking circle that we do, and that same moment or same voice I heard the night before that I thought I was dreaming, I heard it again on the yard. But this time I also saw a vision of myself, of this little girl wrapped up in barbed wire, and I recognized her as me. And so at that point, it's like, now I'm not only hearing voices, I'm seeing things. And this equals being crazy, you know. And I just remember thinking, if there's a God, don't let me lose my mind up in here, because I cannot afford to lose my mind. And as quickly as I saw it, as quickly as it left, nothing else happened after that. But, you know, life went on. That was probably in April of 92. And by June, I think things began to take its course, you know. And I had a 3 to 15 year sentence. And that 3 to 15 year sentence, I had kind of settled in. I knew the routine of prison. I had become accustomed. I knew comfort. I knew how to navigate it. I've done it before. So I felt like the most I was going to do was 3 years. Well, it wasn't like I was a violent offender.
And this was your fifth time in as well.
Mm-hmm.
So you were very,
very,
very
I was
acquainted.
A pro. I was a pro.
You were a pro
at institutions.
Yeah.
I knew how to do institutions. What I didn't know how to do was life in a non-controlled way. So I knew how to do life in a controlled way. Prison institutions, I knew how to do that. Didn't know how to do it in a ungoverned, controlled way, by meaning that I decide my choices. You know what I mean? So fifth time. And in June of that year, I out of nowhere got a call from my public defender. And that public defender pursued me. And I mean, I know now it was pursuit. He was pursuing me. And I don't even know if he was doing it for himself, by himself, within himself. I think that now that I know 30 years, 28 and 29 years later, that when God puts his hand on something, it doesn't matter who it is. You do things that you normally wouldn't do. God shakes things. If he'll speak to a donkey or a rock, he'll speak to even a person who doesn't even know him if he needs to get to where the end result. And I know now that that lawyer was an agent for God. He was coming after me, and he was pursuing me through him. And I think people look for God in so many different ways, and I think we need to look for God in ways of natural ways of how he pursues. He speaks to us through his word. He speaks to us through his examples in his word, but primarily in this moment, he's normally going to speak to us through his word or through his spirit. But most of all, those spirits are going to be also, his Holy Spirit is going to be orchestrated through his people. And so people is his greatest navigator to get to us what he wants us. Any answer, you just wait for good, bad, or indifference. You wait for people will show their colors, and they will. God will speak to them, even in some of the most devastating situations. And I know that lawyer was being used by God 29 years later. I know it. And I sit here because he was obedient. The lawyer was obedient, and he pursued me. And in that pursuit came out of me only doing about 10 and a half months in prison on a 3 to 15 year sentence.
Let me back up for just 1 second. When you heard that voice initially, when you were laying in the bed, and then you heard it with the image again, what was it like, less than a week later as you were out in the yard?
No, it's the next morning.
Next morning, okay. Did you have any concept yourself of who God was?
No. I mean, I knew God. I mean, yeah, I knew that there was a God. I've been in Sunday school, church. All my life, I grew up in church. So, but did I know that he could pursue you through a still small voice? Did I know he could pursue you through other people? No, I didn't. So I didn't know him in a relationship. I knew him as a concept.
Yeah. So it was kind of a completely new thing for you.
Exactly.
So you didn't, but I find it interesting that you didn't completely dismiss it. I mean, you held it and you were like, well, I don't really know what this is. But then the attorney shows up and then things start happening.
Yeah, but I'm going to be honest. I didn't string those pearls to be God until way down the line, you know what I mean? To my conversion, did I string those pearls or those moments up into a necklace to believe that this was God? It came over time.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It wasn't, I thought, again, I went straight to myself, my clever self. Here I am, you know, I'm making it happen. It's, you know, here it is. For the once, I'm getting a break. Everybody else got a break. I've never got a break. And so even down to the letter that I was asked to write, I knew that I remember saying to the lawyer, I'm not begging nobody for nothing. You know, I do my time. I do my crime. I do my time. I ain't begging. And when I get out, I'm going to do what I want to do. So if that means I'm going to be constrained by some man or somebody telling me what to do when I get out, I'm not writing a letter. But again, I was moved and compelled by that which was pursuing me to wake up one morning. And I woke up about 2 o'clock one morning prior, a couple of weeks after the lawyer contacted me. And I wrote this letter. And I tell people now that I don't know if I was in the body or out of the body, but I know it was words that I had never uttered. It was words that I had never conceived that I would utter. And the biggest thing was telling him, you don't really know me because I don't really know myself. And all you know about me is what's written in my file. But my file does not define who I am. Nobody has ever asked me, what happened to you? Why are you acting this way? And I said to the judge, I said, so I'm not sure what you're looking to expect, but I don't make promises because promises have always been broken for me. So I don't know what it is to trust somebody to keep their word to me. So I've only kept my word to myself. So if you're looking for me to say to you, I'm going to do A, B, C, D, and E to get out of here, that's just not going to happen. But if you want to give it me a chance and you want to teach me how to do something different, I'll be willing to learn. But I'm not going to make you no promises. And the judge said he had never really seen a letter in his 30 years on the bench. So compelling.
Wow. And that was the thing that really forced him to, or not forced him, but opened the door.
It compelled him. It compelled him. He said it compelled him. The words were compelled. I didn't know what that word meant at that time, but it pushed him into a place. Matter of fact, everybody said, don't let her out. Every PSI, which is a pre-sentence investigation, the probation officers, they were like, no, she's a criminal. She needs to do her time. She's had chances. She's been in and out of prison and institutions since she was 12. So what makes this time different? I'm 32. I'm almost 31 at that particular time. So they were looking at what makes this different, and
because you were a repeat offender, so they were just basing it on that.
They was basing it on my crimes and not my person.
Yeah.
My color, all of that, I believe, had a play in it. So, the judge said that he was compelled to say, well, if anything, if he lets me out, it's not going to hurt him. That's what he said. Like, okay, I can give her a chance. It's not going to hurt me if she doesn't do the right thing. She'll just go back where she always been, and she'll be what she always is.
Where was your head in all of this? Like, as the judges read that letter and said he felt compelled, as far as you knew you were going to get another chance, like, this was different.
My head was probably looking in, honestly, at that time, my head was looking at what I'm going to do next. I wasn't thinking about this being a defining moment for me, so I can't sit here and say that. No. I was looking at, oh, I'm going to get another chance. I'm going to get out of prison. I'm going to go back and do what I do. Whatever that is, I'm going to survive again. I'm going to go back out. I didn't have a plan. I didn't have a place to live. I went to my sister's. She gave me a couple of weeks. It was just different. Life was different. Everything, nothing that was comfortable before was no longer comfortable.
Hmm.
And I realized that now. It didn't matter, what I did and how I did it. It just, something was different. And I know now, but then I didn't understand it, but I know now that God will, sometimes life will, the very things that you use or have used become the very thing that God will also use to create you to be irritant, like an irritant, like a pearl that he's creating. I believe that my lifestyle, my choices were irritant to me. They no longer was as easy as they used to be. And I think it was because that was no longer the life that he wanted for me, but I had to go on this journey I'm on now. So.
Old ways of coping didn't work. Old situations didn't feel right.
Right.
Yeah. Wow, that's awesome that God created that just to like woo you away from your old life into what he wanted.
Mm-hmm.
So when you got out, there was a point in time where you said you wanted to be different. You wanted things to change. And
but that
so,
wasn't, that. Yeah, that was probably after a couple of weeks at my sister's house on her couch. And she, I'm like, I can't live here. I don't know what I'm going to do. And I remember going uptown, and I was about to still again, I believe, up in Elder Bermans. And because I just was going to get on my feet, because that's what I did. I boosted clothes and usually sell them or whatever. And people think it was because of drugs, my drug addiction. Was money. I never did, in power and control. It never was about drugs, not my addiction. It was, I was addicted to power and control because I had lost so much of it. And so I was about to do that, I think. And the detective, I don't know if he recognized me or he just looked like it, but even that just didn't go off the way I wanted it to. And I remember going back home that night and I went to my probation officer the next morning and I was like, you know what? I need some help. I'm going to end up, that judge said, if I come back, I'm going to do all that time. I believe him. And so I need you to help me. I asked my probation officer. She's a 23, 24-year-old girl. She didn't know what she was doing. She was new to the game. And she was so taken back because she's not used to people asking for help. And she was a young girl. She was Italian. And she went and got her supervisor, Mr. Gray, and... It was so funny because he came in and he's like, oh, what is it? And then she's like, well, she says she wants some help, and I'm not sure what that means, because, you know, her getting help or going to somewhere or getting, you know, only thing we're supposed to do is ask her to get a job and report. And, you know, and it's like, he's like, well, what did the judge order her to do? And my probation officer said, not really anything but stay out of trouble. and he was like, well, I don't know what kind of help you need. I said, one, I need to get out of Hamilton. Two, I need to find somebody to teach me how to do better, because if I don't, it's only inevitable that I'm going to go back to prison. And so he said to me, well, I'll tell you what, there's a program in Cincinnati. I'm not sure if they'll take you, because there's a lot of criteria. You know, you got to check off so many lists, and they don't take people off the street, and the judge has to order you there, and it's just all these things. And I think he was discouraging me. He said, but if you're serious, come back tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock, and we'll see what we can do. And I came back, and that day, it was in August. I got out August the 9th, and all of this happened within a week and a half, probably. So about the 20th of August, I went back there about the 23rd of August of 1992, and I went to jail that day. The judge ordered me to the Talbert House here in Cincinnati, and the only way you could go to the Talbert House is go from jail. Mm-hmm. They would do unjudicial, and so I went to jail. But you know what? That was the best 6 weeks, because I didn't get out of there until September 28th. So from August the 23rd to September 28th, it was the greatest 6 weeks of my life, because it solidified that there's a difference between doing time and spending time. And so in that moment, I felt like that time I chose. And I didn't even know what it was going to look like, but I knew it had to be different than what it was. And so I was willing to do whatever I needed to do to get whatever I needed to get. And the journey began.
Were you focusing or operating out of a place of hope or determination?
Determination. I'm not going to be proven wrong. Yeah. Determination, not hope, because I didn't really even connect that pearl of hope. I didn't know those words, hope. What was that? Yeah, it was determined, grit.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I'm going to make it happen. Self-will. Yeah.
And I think God uses that in people, like, to another one of those things, kind of like the attorney that the public defender came to you and was, mm-hmm. like, really set on doing what he was doing, the fact that you heard the voice. I mean, God can use those moments to really drive our life forward and give us what we need, even when we don't realize what we need.
Exactly.
It sounds to me like the verse in the Bible that says he will answer us before we call. So you hadn't even called, and he was beginning to answer you with what you needed.
See, I think he was answering a prayer that other people prayed.
Yeah.
You know, the mother that raised me, I think he was answering her prayer. She had passed away a couple of years before then. She said it was well with her soul. I think he was answering her prayer.
Which prayer? Those kinds of prayers have so much power. Mm-hmm. So much power.
Yeah.
To change a life, to alter the trajectory of someone.
Mm-hmm.
So.
And so there were years of prayers and seeds sown and planted, and I think they were just coming to fruition and coming into existence and in its own way.
So you were 6 weeks back in. You mm-hmm. weren't doing time. You were spending your time mm-hmm. and
reading the Bible in my cell. Just kind of was just different. It wasn't, you know, it was just something about it that was different, that I knew that I wanted something more than I had and didn't really know how to articulate it or how to obtain it, but I knew I wanted it. And so even with pure grit and determination, I knew that I wanted it. And so I was willing to do whatever I needed to do to get it.
And that determination followed you when you got out as well, because mm-hmm. I think I heard you say one time you approached your time at the Talbert House just a little bit different, in that you were like keeping people away.
Well, I think I approached it with setting the boundaries. They're called boundaries. I know this life well enough. I know humans. You know, I have a PhD in the study of humanity. For many reasons. One, because of my own woundedness. Two, because of I think it's just a gift that God gave me. And three, because God was going to need me to have the spirit of discernment and some prophetic gifts. So I think I have that with people. I can kind of read people quickly. I can scan the room quickly. I know the, you know, I just know people. And when I say know them, meaning I don't necessarily know them from the depths of God and how he knows them, but I do know people from the humanity part of how they operate. And I say that from my own life, because when you know what you've done and how you've operated, most of us are not different. We're more alike than we are different. We just do it for different reasons, but usually we're more alike than we are different. Mm. And so when I came into the Talbert House, I just set a boundary to say, you don't need to know why I'm here. You don't need to know my name. I'm telling you now. If, in fact, you do something to affect me in a negative way, I'm going to tell on you. Because I know how to do bad all by myself. If you ain't in it to help me to get where I'm trying to go, stay out of my way. If you are, then come alongside me. If you're not, just remember, I'm going to tell on you. And you can tell on me if you see me doing something wrong. Because I didn't know then that was accountability and boundaries, but it was. Again, I was operating from a place I didn't even know what I was doing. And so it set up real good boundaries with the other women. They knew I wasn't about, you know, I wasn't about the pettiness or the playing. They knew that I was about my business, and my business I was about. And so, yeah, by that time, I probably had been in the Talbert House. The first day I went in there, I said that. And I stayed in the Talbert House from the 28th of September to January the 3rd, 1993.
Wow.
So.
Well over 2 months.
2.5 months, yeah. About 3 months.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I love that you were able to do that without ever knowing what that was, that was setting boundaries.
Mm-hmm.
So when you got out, what were, like, how did you experience getting out of the Talbert House and then trying to do life? Because I know one thing you had said was places where you go after prison, they can be too quick.
Well, they were too quick, 93 days. It took me 30-something years to get in the position I was in, and then you gave me 93 days to try to figure it out.
Right.
I left Talbert House going to the Anna Louise Inn House, which is another community living for women that was downtown. So I went there, and by this time I'm working at Fisher's, the restaurant Fisher's. I'm a host, and then I moved up from a host to a cashier because I, again, told the truth to the manager that I didn't really trust myself to be a cashier, or, you know what I mean, and I didn't really see myself being a server, you know what I mean, because my attitude was still stupid and crazy. So, but I did believe I could be a host and greet people and send them down and give them a menu. And he was really impressed that I just told him the truth.
You told him like it was. Yeah.
And then he eventually moved me up to being a cashier at the carryout window. And so, you know, it's just different little things that happen in that moment. And so I began to pursue counseling. Nancy Smith Gosselin was my counselor. She did me as a in-service kind of, you know, advocate. I didn't have no insurance. I didn't have no money to pay her. She just said, okay, I'll take your case. And she used to come and do it. She did our assessments at Talbert House. And so I just asked her, like, when she did my assessment, would she help me, you know, counsel me, tap me into, you know, whatever is going on with me, why I am like I am. And I knew why I was, to some degree, why I knew what had happened to me. I didn't know that those things really was residual effects and outcomes by other people's fingerprints and patterns of their own destructive behaviors touching my life. I didn't understand that then, but I did know that I had been through some things. And she said, yes, she would take on my case, and she did. She walked me through, and that's how I got introduced to the child within.
Was it hard to dig into at first? Like, not knowing how those things in your childhood affected you, and yet you're in a counseling situation, and you've taken care of yourself, and you've got the strong, determined grit, and now you're talking to someone who's wanting to really dig into those early places, deep places.
You know, I think I'm an avid learner. So for me, I didn't connect to it emotional. I connect with it as a task, again, as an outcome, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
And so just to be informed, you know, I'm very perceptive. So it's like I needed to be informed. So looking back at it, it was more about trying to learn what should be my next move, you know, and how, again, the objective was to stay out of prison, period. It wasn't never about to get better. See what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. I didn't go into counseling to get better. I went into counseling to stay out of prison. That's a difference.
Yeah.
Now, getting better or doing the work eventually came, but my first introduction was not about getting better.
So how did you process, like, all of those moments and all those counseling sessions where she was probably really trying to get you to look into some early stuff?
Mm-hmm. I just kind of dealt with it. I, you know, I got informed. I realized that my mother giving me away was a spirit, you know, was a lack of development in identity. And so I realized, okay, that is why. Okay, I can understand. I can connect that dot. Okay, yeah, all right, I can see that. The man abusing me. I was able to identify, because by that time I had dealt with homosexuality. I dealt with, you know, being promiscuous, you know, just kind of all kind of sexual things. So, okay, she told me that. Oh, okay, I can connect that dot. So it was all about connecting the dots.
Mm-hmm.
And so choosing new behaviors, you know what I mean? Just like I got the information, then I got to do something different. I can't do the same thing. So, you know, I never really, it was just always about knowledge for me in the beginning. And so she dug and I dug and I was present, and I'm sure I cried here or there, you know what I mean? But mm-hmm. It was more for me, the motivation behind it was not to heal, it was to inform. And so to inform myself on how not to go back to prison.
That's interesting. It feels like little seeds taking you, or little steps taking you to where then you really got to the deeper healing.
And yeah, I think that it goes back, it reminds me of the book, my first book that I read was The Road Less Traveled by Scott Peck. And when I look back at that book now and I read it, it reminds me again about knowledge and information and understanding. And he does a lot of quoting from the scripture. And just like at Tabard House, when I met the young lady, Benita Spraggins, and she took me to Christ Emmanuel, and I had never experienced church that way. And I knew that the fellowship of a community was probably something, which, you know, I've never really tried it. So what, again, let's do something I've never done. And got connected, went to catechism classes, went to classes, and that became my community support as well. So it was almost like things were happening simultaneously at this, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And I was going to the council, I got connected to the church. So those things were all, again, I now know that those were strings of pearls. He was straining the pearls that he was going to give me back, which is my life. But he did it, and life happened in a way. His best for me was never to go to prison. His best for me was never to live the life I had. And yet, he was taking me back to recollect the pearl that I have always been to him.
Hmm.
The diamond I have always been.
Yeah.
And so he was straining up a necklace of diamond and pearls and showing me, this was my best for you. And you've got to go back and collect it, but you got to go back and face, and you got to go back and understand, and you got to go back and be informed, and then you got to be willing to make new choices out of new information. The emotions will come eventually. You'll feel it, but right now it's best. Some people are more knowledge head, like it says in the Enneagram. Some people do the head. Mm-hmm. Some people do the heart.
Mm-hmm.
Some people do the emotions. And I'm more of a head and, you know, body person. You know what I mean? So it makes it even more understanding now that why he would pearl his diamond, give me a diamond and pearl necklace in the way that he has.
Very cool. Well, I think we're going to wrap it up right there, and we're going to continue this conversation in subsequent podcasts. Thank you for your time. I'm really excited to see where this journey goes for other people, hearing your story, hearing your hope, hearing you just how you've come from that particular situation at 31 to where you are now, which it's an awesome journey. You guys are really going to love hearing this. So thank you.
You're welcome.
You've been listening to the Embracing Change podcast. Music production and mastering by Gone Coastal Productions. Podcast editing and production by Jennifer Osborne. Podcast copyright 2020 by Lacrita Bowman.